Welcome into This Has to Work. Joining me today is Elliot Potter.
Hello.
Elliot is an avid reader, tinkerer, and co-founder of Link, a digital networking and connection enablement platform that takes physical connections and turns them into digital assets. Elliot and his co-founders came from Shipt, the grocery delivery service purchased by Target at the end of 2017. Welcome to the show, Elliot.
Man, thank you so much. I wish I had you to introduce me everywhere I go. That was great.
How good or bad was that description of Link?
So fully candid, I did not give Matt that description. I think that's great. I think that's better than I could have done. You know, I'm good thing you're an investor in Link.
Well, it's a little tough from the standpoint of, full disclosure, I am an investor in Link. Part of that is you have so many products, you guys do so many different things. It is kind of hard to capture it in kind of the elevator pitch. But we'll get into some of the details a little bit. So I mentioned in the opening that you guys, all three of you, so you, Jared, and Patrick, mm-hmm. Were all kind of early or mid-stage kind of employees. I think Patrick was like in the first 25 or something.
He beat me. He was like number four. I was number six.
Oh, wow. Okay. No.
We were close.
I was throttling you guys back. It was way earlier than I thought. Yeah. So, but you guys were on kind of that wild ride, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but you left Shipt and then immediately jumped into your own startup. So the fundamental question here is, what is wrong with you?
Oh, so many things. This was 2019 when we launched Link. It was right before COVID, which we did not know was coming, obviously. What is wrong with us? So Shipt was a wild ride. I went straight from a music business degree to Shipt, and music business is definitely in my nature of kind of tinkering, creative, all that. Had no experience in technology or entrepreneurship before Shipt, and graduated from school. One of my best friends from high school, Charlie McLaughlin, was between Patrick and I at Shipt. I think I was closer to number 10, actually. But Charlie was like before Patrick. He was like number two.
Oh, okay.
And he had seen this Craigslist ad for this local tech company in Birmingham as a delivery driver, and he signed up, went into the office in a suit, and Bill Smith, the founder, was like, "You seem like a sharp guy. What if you just came and work at headquarters? We're not doing much now, but I have a good feeling." Charlie was like, "Whatever." Very long story short, I was either going to go do a free internship in Nashville, be an unpaid starving artist, or make a little money at this tech company in Birmingham as a customer service employee, and then go do my music thing. Well, they turned me down for customer service, and I was like, wow. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek.
That's a bit of a kick to the teeth.
They were like, "We don't think you're qualified." I was like, dude.
I have a college degree.
Yeah, I'm like, come on. I'm answering the phone. But it was a little tongue-in-cheek. They were like, we actually want you to do this other thing called City Launch, which was take Shipt to new cities. And I was like, that sounds like fun. I get to travel. I get to host launch parties at bars. I was like, why not do that? Bill was very aggressive in his launch schedule, and I quickly found myself overwhelmed with work. And as a way to get more done, I started to tinker with Zapier, kind of a no-code automation platform. Eventually bumped up against limits there, needed more functionality, so I started to tinker with code. Really wish I'd had ChatGPT. That would have been clutch. Would have accelerated my career by like 6 years, because I took a long time to figure out. But between, you know, tinkering and getting help from some guys at Shipt, learned how to code, and then once I learned how to code, I fell completely in love with the idea of startups, the practice of startups, the theory of startups. I couldn't get enough of going faster, doing more. It's kind of my nature. So anyway, there's a lot wrong with us, but essentially we caught the startup bug. By 2019, Shipt had matured a lot. You know, Bill, the founder, had left, and we were like, we got to go recreate this magic, because there wasn't a fun enough startup right around the corner. We were like, we got to go do it ourselves.
So you mentioned Bill Smith, the founder of Shipt, and Bill is probably one of, if not the most ambitious kind of startup leader I've really ever come to know to any real degree. Mm-hmm. And he drives hard. I mean, he is ambitious. Oh, yeah. He's the sky's the limit, and maybe not even that. And so, as you were working, because you guys were working very closely at the early stages with him, during that whole process, that massive growth, for anybody who doesn't know, Shipt basically went from zero to a 500 million plus exit to target in 3 years.
It was nuts.
It was crazy. So in that, how did that influence you as you started to approach your own startup?
Great question. Bill and I worked very closely together. He gets into the details more than just about anybody I know. Early on, I mean, it was tough. I didn't know what I was getting into. I didn't know who Bill was. I didn't know what startups were. And so my expectations of the pace of a, first of all, my expectations generally were very low, just being honest. Like, coming from Birmingham, I'd never been downtown. I didn't know anything about startups at all, much less the Birmingham tech startup scene. In the back of my head, it was like Silicon Valley's where tech startups happen. And so when my buddy tells me about this tech startup in Birmingham, I'm like, I'm going to maybe learn some things, but I need to make some money. This is a layup of a position. But I actually fell in love with the high standards, the pace, the ambition. And Bill, you know, encapsulates all that. So all that to say, working very closely with Bill early on, we butted heads pretty hard. I mean, he'd tell you too, I almost lost my job several times. And it was other people advocating, you know, probably just by the nature of the position and, you know, how few people we had doing so many things that I didn't get fired. But now Bill has become a mentor of mine. He's an investor of ours now. And, you know, obviously things have changed a lot. We earned each other. I earned his trust. You know, he didn't need to earn mine really. So it was challenging, but this idea, my mentor in college was a guy named Brad Moffitt, and reminds me a lot of Bill in a lot of ways, a little bit less intense, a little bit more kind of quiet, aggressive. But in college, I fell in love with this idea of high standards and the pursuit of excellence and ambition and intensity in all that you do. And Bill is kind of a different flavor of that I vibed with a lot more than I had in college. Mm. Because I could see myself doing it. I wasn't quite the wise mentor that Dr. Moffitt was, but I could see myself eventually becoming potentially an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of what I fell in love with. Beyond just the pace of the startup was like Bill's energy, his ambition, his aggression. I was like, why not be that way? Why would I want to live life any other way? For me, it just resonated. And he taught me a ton. How does it translate to today? That's a lot of pressure. Coming from Shipt, it was a very fast, wild success, win for the city, all that stuff. And I felt pressure, especially early on, to be more like Bill, I think, and be, you know, not just Bill, just people that I wasn't, entrepreneurs that I looked up to. And this is so cliche, but I'm convinced that everybody has to experience the reality of cliches to realize they're cliches. You can't just tell somebody something and them apply it or believe it, but you got to be yourself. You got to do you. And so I bring different things to the table. And the more that I've leaned into that, the better it's been for everybody, me included.
Yeah. One of the things that I have watched kind of in your maturation as a CEO is there, you know, I've never worked with Bill directly. But there's a lot of things about the way I've watched you develop as the CEO and leader of your company. In so many ways, it's very different than how I expect it would have been at Shipt. So there's got to be some takeaways that mm-hmm. are gained from that experience, but also to maturity. And we'll kind of circle back to a little bit of kind of where you are in your life and how that all plays into being a startup founder, because frankly speaking, I don't think we talk about that enough. But before we do that, let's get to Link, because that's really, I think, the meat of the matter here. Mm-hmm. As I said in the beginning, I did my best to try to encapsulate a lot of what Link does in that intro. I don't think I did it full justice. So how would you describe Link's suite of products?
Yeah. So a little backstory there, because I can't help myself. When we started, I would like to say that we started with this grand vision of how the world could be. It was tinkering. We were tinkering around in our apartment, Jared and I. And one night, we actually had another business, quote unquote, that we had started. It was kind of a marketing consultancy thing with a tech aspect to it. But we were selling it to small business owners and they liked it. And we had some revenue. And the thing we ran into was people were always interested. They always wanted to buy. It was like $40 a month. It wasn't expensive. We didn't have a good way to get them to pay us fast. And, you know, Stripe existed, Squarespace existed. But what we were looking for was some hybrid of get them to take action quickly in a digital way, not like fill out a paper form. Get them to take action, but then also maintain and persist this line of communication with the person. So what we landed on was, could we give people a digital business card that talked about our business, that got their info, gave them our info, and let us transact later? So we had this idea. We're mulling over it over the course of a few weeks. And one day we were in the car on the way out to Moody, Alabama, very exotic place where my parents live, to have dinner. And in the car, we were like, what if we just put a digital business card behind a QR code? And at the time, we did not do any market research. We had no idea that companies had tried this. We had no idea that there were active startups trying to pursue this. We just thought, that's a great idea. We build the prototype in Moody that night. We start to sell it. So
all great tech ideas usually start in Moody, right?
Moody at the kitchen table. Yeah. So we rushed through dinner. I mean, it really did. Part of how I know this is my calling is like anytime we get on an idea now where it's a feature idea or a product idea, you know, the same obsession that comes over me when I was like making a song in college or in high school, I would just stay up all night. It was that same, we were like getting through dinner like it was Christmas morning to go build this thing. So we build it. We do the mom test. We show it to my family, my grandparents, and everyone's like, you know, they're usually supportive of kind of business ideas, but everyone was like, oh, this has legs. Because there was this virality component to it where somebody scanned the QR code on my phone. They didn't need an app. All of a sudden, they filled out a quick form. We exchanged info through a text message, and then they were a user, you know, and they had this digital card in their Apple wallet all of a sudden, and it was spreading. So all that to say, the original idea was, could we connect people faster in person and let our users present somebody with a quick call to action and a way to persist communication? So what Link has evolved into, still, you could still sum us up as a digital business card, but, you know, platform of digitizing these real world interactions, turning them into digital assets, I think is a little bit more apt. Because beyond the digital business card, we work with people like Abercrombie and Fitch, who you may have seen on our, you know, our website and LinkedIn. And Abercrombie doesn't use us for digital business cards. They use our QR codes and our products in their stores to quickly capture people's information that come in and that are interested in working for the store. So they're using us as like a job application collector. There are some real estate shops that use us in their open houses across the country to communicate information about the house and capture that person as a lead. So it all comes back to, how do I digitize this interaction? Give me a way to continue the conversation and basically convert this person as a lead into something more, whether I'm a small business owner and they're a full-on customer, or I'm a real estate shop and they're a lead for this property. Digital connection platform, I think, pretty well encapsulates it, but it started with a humble digital business card.
Well, what I think, you know, so much tech and so many platforms were focused on digital to digital. Yeah. Right. So you come in, you fill out this form on a website that somehow puts you into a marketing automation or sales flow or whatever the case may be. But it started digital, continued as digital. What I think was novel was you guys recognized, you know, there's still a lot of like IRL, you know, human to human contact that's happening. And the problem is that creates a major breakage point for turning that into an asset.
For sure.
Right. So it's I forget what the stat was that we looked at originally, but it was something around the average, you know, kind of wallet life of a business card that was handed to somebody was less than 2 weeks.
Less than a week, and 88% were thrown away within a week.
Yeah. Right. And then you look at, and you talk to any sales manager, and you talk about what percentage of contacts are making it from your salespeople into your CRM to do anything with. And if they're being honest with you, it's probably 20% or less.
Who knows?
So you're paying for all of this, you know, interaction, for all of this travel, for all of this, you know, face to face, and you're literally only ever capturing 20% at best this information. So it never gets to the point where you're taking that and turning it into an actual asset, or at least an asset that you can do something with in modern business terms, right? Nobody's mailing letters to people, but they are emailing them, right? They are sending them, you know, targeted ads, they're doing those other things, but you have to have that digital connection at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I think of culture in terms of these pendulum swings, and I actually had this kind of gut feeling when I thought my career was going to be music at first, I had this idea for, you know, I saw people handing out mixtapes and, you know, putting their link in bio for their album and stuff. And the pendulum for so long was digital everything. You think like 2010 to 15-ish, it was like social. That was the golden age of social media. Everybody's starting a new thing. LinkedIn is taking off. And like, it's cool. We saw the same cycle happen with metaverse. It was like, oh, we're going meta. And it's like, oh no, actually not quite. Yeah. I don't know if we'll ever be to Ready Player One status because people crave real world interaction. Like the most dopamine you get, naturally is like seeing somebody else's face. It's not watching videos. You can fry your dopamine receptors scrolling TikTok, but that's not what we're made for. And so what we saw was, you know, I have this idea too, that some founders start out with a vision of how the world's going to be. And they just, from the get, they see it. Other founders and other companies start with a hunch. Steven Johnson in this book, Where Good Ideas Come From, calls it the slow hunch. And over time, layers of an onion are revealed to them about how the world could be. That's more how we've operated. Like we started Link on this hunch. When we pitched you, it wasn't digital business cards. It was this kind of end manifestation of what we thought the platform could be, which was something to compete with LinkedIn. Still believe that that's a possibility for us. But the whole time it's been around the notion of in-person interactions are the most powerful ones we have. There's a hole in the market for capturing value from those. And that's where we sit.
So looking at the first version that you described of Link, you saw just a bunch of copycats come out. And I say copycats for a reason, which is like you literally had people trying to steal your font style.
Still do.
You have people that are buying, you know, basically Google AdWords that have your name in it. Mm-hmm. They are creating products that are facsimiles of your early products. But those companies are largely struggling now. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that to like celebrate their failure or anything like that. I'm not doing that. But what I am saying is they didn't iterate on their product seemingly as fast as you did. And they didn't have this larger vision that you're laying out, which is it's great that you can make these connections, but mm-hmm. that's not the power in what you can do with that. It's what's next that is powerful. So for you, is that right? I mean, what has made Link, you know, successful in kind of this digital connection space where others have either struggled to grow or, frankly speaking, struggled to stay around?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this used to give me a lot of heartburn. You know, I was like, oh, this is our idea. You know, like I said, when we started, we didn't know that other companies were even doing this. I'll never forget. I was at Bamboo like 2 weeks after we quit our jobs. And one of our friends, Rashir, who's the CEO of a company called PopChew in New York, very cool company. We worked with him at Shipt. He was in town for Shipt at that point, and he was like, have you guys seen these people? And he shows us a competitor that's been around for like 4 years at this point. And we were like, nope. That's interesting, though. You know, so we were so unaware of the competitive nature of this market from the beginning. But to your point, I mean, good ideas attract competition. That's why it's easier sometimes to build a super niche product and achieve success before anybody sees you coming. So for us, that was bothersome at first. We were like, dude, this is our thing. How are they so shameless in copying us? But you know, what we've come around to is, first of all, that's pretty flattering. A lot of people do copy the things we do. And that to me is, it's halfway a signal that we're doing something right. Halfway a signal that, you know, our market isn't very creative, which is a little sad. I'd rather have stiffer competition than copycats. But what we've seen too, I mean, I don't fault some of these companies, you know, just like, in college, one of my side hustles was a vintage clothing Instagram store. You know, that wasn't my idea. It also wasn't an idea I wanted to see through for 10 years and build into a, you know, world-changing company. It was just something, it was a way for me to make money. And so I think a lot of these companies saw an opportunity. COVID accelerated this whole notion of contactless connection. And I think a lot of companies saw an opportunity to make some cash and graduate college. You know, who knows? Maybe they were college kids. But for us, it was, again, bothersome at first. It took some customers from us at first. But really what we're seeing as the market matures, I mean, it's 5 years old at this point or older. The customers that want to innovate and grow with us are not interested in flash in the pan kind of money-making scheme. They want persistent long-term connection with the people that they're meeting. And that's what we've indexed on as a product.
One of the things that you guys have done successfully many times over at this point is getting feedback from customers from the market, mm-hmm. talking about, hey, could we use Link or Link products to do X, Y, and Z? Mm-hmm. And it's legitimately things you guys hadn't considered before.
Oh yeah.
I mean, to the point, and then profitable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, things are like real opportunities to do those kinds of things. What kind of really sticks out to me in that, not just the fact that you're receptive to that, which I think is kind of the baseline expectation, mm-hmm. but the fact that you have a relationship built with customers that they will bring this stuff to you yeah. almost in a partnership type mentality.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that happens with everyone. So you guys are making some sort of connection mm-hmm. with your users, with your customers that I think is fairly singular or is certainly uncommon.
Yeah, I would say that's for a couple of reasons. You know, one, we're constantly thinking about relationship building. That's kind of the thesis of the company is how do we help people build deeper relationships faster with the people they meet? So we kind of have to be good at that. It's like eating our own
dog food.
Eating your own dog food. Yeah. Yeah. And so we kind of have to be good
own,
at that.
Drinking your own
drinking
Kool-Aid.
Your own Kool-Aid. That's yeah. what I was looking for. Okay. And so if we're not good at that, it's like we're probably fraudulent. So that's one thing. And another thing I would say, you know, we're a pretty open-minded bunch. All of us, the three founders, we score pretty high on open-mindedness as like a character trait. And again, I think it goes back to the type of founder that you are. There are people who believe they're right about the world from the get. And sometimes those are colossal failures and sometimes they're massive successes. I would rather be more open-minded about how the world's going and sometimes zig when it zags, but sometimes zig when it zigs. You know, you don't want to buck up against human behavior so much that you run yourself out of business. And so, yeah, I mentioned a few, the real estate and Abercrombie. We've had a few really creative use cases that we would have never anticipated for the product, but have taken us down some really interesting paths. And again, like we have guardrails. We're not going to go build, you know, we're not going to go build something so tangential that it doesn't make sense. But
well, and that's a challenge sometimes because you have a talented team. You know, yeah. I opened this up by calling you a tinkerer. And if anybody doesn't know, that's high praise and received as such, I think, Elliot, by you being called that because you guys are constantly moving and trying new things and you have talented technical mm-hmm. folks. You have talented marketing folks. You have talented salespeople. So you have the ability to go a million different directions at a time. How do you look at an opportunity and go, this is what we should pursue. This is what we're going to, you know, put resources toward.
Yeah. It's definitely a blessing and a curse. I think resource constraints can be a beautiful thing because they force you to focus. We're definitely resource constrained. We have 23 employees. You know, we've definitely felt the pressure of kind of everything going on. But on the other hand, we have a very talented team. I'm a technical founder. Patrick's technical. You know, Jared's on his way. Jared can sell paint off the wall. And so we have a lot of kind of firepower in the company for trying a lot of things, which can be dangerous. But I would say the filter for us is as much results as it is guts. For a long time, you know, we had telemetry on everything. We were measuring how long you looked at a page, what you clicked on, how often you came back. And I don't think that stuff's bad, but you can get overwhelmed with data pretty quickly. And telemetry is not the answer to everything. And again, it's a cliche that I'm kind of realizing the reality of over time. But as an entrepreneur, you got to trust your gut. Your gut is what got you started, right? We had no data. We did zero market research. We did zero anything. We just had this gut feeling and it just snowballed into a real company. And I think there's this temptation as at least a first-time entrepreneur to get away from that pretty quickly. You're like, oh, no, now I'm sophisticated. We have funding. We have amplitude. We have data. And you get away from that. And I think that's a mistake to get away from it totally. Obviously, have guardrails up. Have guideposts as to is this right or not. But you know what? Over the last 2 years, the guide for us has been gut and revenue. Is mm-hmm. it making money? Mm-hmm. You know, like growth is good, but more than ever, money as a business should always be really good. It's kind of the metric at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I still go back to the Bezos thing, right? Which is the key to innovation is fail fast, fail often, fail cheap.
Yeah.
Right. But it's kind of like a stool. You have to have all three of those legs or the thing falls over, right? Yep. You can't fail often and fast and expensive, mm-hmm. right? Because you can no longer fail often because yeah. it's too expensive.
You're in your own business.
So you can try as many things as you want as long as those kind of those stool legs stay in place. All right. So shifting gears a little bit, I always think this is important to talk about with founders, but you have two young kids.
Yeah, I do.
You know, and so how are you balancing a high growth startup mm-hmm. with being a husband, a father, mm-hmm. and also being a founder and leader of other people who are relying on you in almost every imaginable mm-hmm. capacity?
No pressure.
Right.
Yeah. It's hard. It is way hard. This is by far harder. I mean, 10 times harder than I ever thought it was going to be. I think that's part of the magic of being a founder is it's like layers of an onion revealed difficulty. You know, it just gets harder, which is awesome because each layer prepares you for the next one. I feel like I'm on level 10. There could be a level 11. We'll see. So I have an almost 2-year-old and a 2.5-month-old. They're both Ford is the older one and Atlas is the younger, two boys. First of all the good genes came from my wife, Taylor. She doesn't know what anxiety is, which is insane to me. She's felt it like once in her life because of bad medicine. It was like a total fluke. She doesn't get sad. I mean, she's amazingly emotionally resilient. She's a stay-at-home mom. So Tay is bearing definitely most of the kind of brunt of this like early stage work with the boys. But they're also just really good boys. Like they're so chill. They're kind, they're smart, and you know, as smart as like a 2.5-month-old can be. But they're just good. They're both good babies. They're good kids. So I do feel blessed in that they genetically have not given us too hard of a time, all attributed to Tay. Tay is also, I could not ask for a better support system than her. She's absolutely unbelievable. You've met her. I mean, she's just a ray of sunshine to everybody she meets. And she's a great yin to my yang, which can be storm cloud of action, aggression, you know, anxiety all fueled into one, like, we got to do this. So it's definitely hard. And it keeps getting harder, but I feel prepared for each new kind of level. Maybe I tap out at some point. I mean, at this point, I'm so far in, like, well, I don't think I'm going to.
Well, kind of continuing on that thread, the name of this podcast is This Has to Work. And that's really,
hell yeah, it does.
It's really an homage to founders. I mean, that's who we interview on this show. That's who we talk about on this show. This is the insights that we get are from mm-hmm. founders. And, you know, they're putting their personal, professional, financial well-being at risk by doing this, so this has to work. So for you, and as it relates to Link, why does this have to work for you?
I mean, for so many reasons, on paper, off paper. One of the things that Bill told me early on that I'll never forget was your first one's your hardest, for sure. You don't have anything to fall back on. You know, I could go be an engineer somewhere if I absolutely had to, but you know, I think the other side of the coin of this is the hardest one, I do plan on starting other companies, I'm hooked, is the desperation. It has to work, like you said. I mean, just practically, this is all my net worth is tied up in Link, so I'm not going to let it die. Just no way. And I'm trying to hold on to, in the same way that I'm trying to hold on to all these early memories with the boys, first Christmases, you know, roughing it with Tay in our first house. I mean, you hear from people later in life all the time that those are some of the most beautiful times. And I don't want to look past that and I don't want to rush that. And the same with the company. You know, there will be other companies or there will be, maybe I'm at Link for 40 years. I don't know. I could see Link becoming one of those world-changing legacy companies with thousands of employees and, you know, operating all over the world. I really can't. And maybe I'm still there. But it's going to be different. It's going to be a totally different. We're going to go through several phases of the company. One of the other things Bill harped on early on at Shipt was the first Christmas party we had up in the John Hand Club. There was probably 40 of us up there. And he was like, these are the good old days. He's like, you don't realize it yet, but these are the days you're going to look back on. And sure enough, those early days at Shipt were totally my favorite. Same with Link. And so it's super tough. I mean, I do a lot outside of work to maintain my mental health, my physical health, workout every day, super strict diet, which is annoying. I've heard people say that discipline is freedom, and that's how I feel about it. It can be annoying, but generally the discipline of doing those things gives me the freedom to operate at 100% at work, which I'm totally neurotic about. I'm super annoying about, you know, when my friends are going out and want to drink, I'm usually like, I can't because I got to work Monday. And they're like, it's Friday. And I'm like, trust me, I'll feel it. And it's super neurotic. But at the same time, I'm truly trying to give it, we all are, like everybody at the company is trying to give it 110%. And so it's hard, but I see it as a super fun opportunity that I'm going to look back on fondly. Whether the company goes up in flames or is a 40-year legacy success, I'm going to miss it either way. So trying to soak it up.
I do think that entrepreneurs, and I count myself among them, you know, founders count myself among them. I think you build up scar tissue. I mean,
yeah,
I joke around all the time. Like I lost my like risk aversion, like kind of gag reflex years ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, you know, just pile it on.
Whatever.
It's just the next thing.
Yeah.
And I literally got to a point recently where I realized I'm actually looking at risk now as optionality.
100%.
Because if you think about it from the standpoint of if risk is being presented, it's because something is changing.
Yeah.
And so in that change inherently lies an opportunity. Now, it could be an opportunity to fail.
Yep.
It could be an opportunity to stub your toe or have a setback or whatever. But it could also be an opportunity to unlock something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think without the context of being nervous, of truly worrying about it, having anxiety about it, thinking about payroll, thinking about runway, thinking about all of these things and making these decisions for which all these other people rely on you, it's I think at some point in time you start to rationalize it, and that's fine. But if you can't ever go back to a period in time and remember when it's like, no, I absolutely had that gag reflex and there were a lot of sleepless nights, I think it helps to kind of ground you. I think it also helps for you to recognize some of the success that you have as you overcome those periods of time. And to that point, you guys have some impressive logos on your page.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever allow yourself to kind of step back and go, holy cow, we're doing it. This thing is happening. Like we're having conversations with people that I never thought would even take my phone call, let alone do business and partner with us.
Yeah. We just did a deal today. I had that thought. I would say sometimes, usually it's me and Jared and Patrick, the other two founders. We'll be in a meeting. We'll be talking about a problem going on. And we'll step back after a moment of silence and we'll say, you know what? It's a blessing that we're up against this problem. I frame things as problems of success. People will be like, well, you know, what if this happens and they want more units than we have? Or, you know, what if we need more engineers to get this done? And it's like, guys, that's a problem of success. That means we've done something right. Being alive almost 5 years into this idea is these are all problems of success. And so we frame it a lot of times as like, look, especially now there's a lot of companies that are going out of business that are probably more deserving than we are and have worked harder and have raised more money and have been more diligent. But like so much of this is luck. So much of this is right place, right time that, you know, I'm thrilled that we're here. I do try to treat every day as a gift, and yeah, not often enough, but every now and then it's usually to correctly frame a problem we're facing is like, hey, we've done something, you know, for better or for worse, we've done something.
So given that basic or basis of comparison or basis of kind of context, what's next for Link? What are you guys excited about?
Great question. Without saying too much, you know, you guys, Mucker, all of our investors, the first thing that everyone has said when we've pitched them or when we first started getting to know somebody is, all right, but it's not business cards. Like it's got to be bigger than business cards. And obviously it is. And the next phase of Link is about taking you beyond that first interaction and continuing the relationship, which has always been the goal. It's been a little, we've taken a little while to get here. And I think we've taken exactly the amount of time we've needed to, because what we're building and what we're working on is by far the most excited I've ever been about the product. And so stay tuned. I mean, we've talked about it, but it's all centered around how do we take you to the next step in the relationship in a way that truly feels magical. I think the highest compliment you can get as a product is, first of all, somebody's money. So when we talk about revenue as the goal, it's not because we're money hungry. It's because if someone's willing to give you their money, they want it, they need it, or they believe in it. And the second highest praise you can get is somebody saying, this feels like magic. And that's some of the early feedback we've gotten about this new product. And so, yeah, stay tuned. I'm excited.
All right. So curveball question for you.
Yeah.
You're an avid reader. And you don't just read, I mean, you're like me, you read a lot of nonfiction, a lot of business books, mentorship books. But is there a book that you can remember reading that had nothing to do with business or startups or tech that actually influenced the way that you look at your startup or the way that you interact with people within your organization or anything kind of like that? I mean, I'll give you an easy one. And if this is your answer, I apologize. But like The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein, right?
Oh,
like
yeah.
That's a classic one where people go back and they go, okay, yeah, it's a parable. It's it's a life lesson. It's all of these things. But it's also too about going back and saying, okay, like how much can I give to others? How much and in which capacities and all of those ways, which I think directly translates into managing and leading other people and all of those things. So is there an example that you can think of?
It's a really good question. I'd like to think of one that's a little more abstract like that, like maybe a novel from early on. You know, this is way back. Some of the most influential books I ever read were the Redwall series as a kid. It's about these mice that like took over the world. And to me, that was such an imaginative story. It really just kind of stoked my imagination. And, you know, I believe in not doing anything unless you're having fun. And I think hard, grueling work can be fun. I think trying to do it with two young kids, young family can be fun. So a lot of the books I read as a kid were just take my imagination for a wild ride. And, as a startup, that's kind of what you're doing. You're building things that don't exist. You're creating worlds. You're trying to sell something to customers that's never been done. At least the flavor of startups I like. But more recently, so I would say generally the Knights of Redwall really impacted me as a kid. The C.S. Lewis books, Chronicles of Narnia, those were big for me. But more recently, the book I'm reading right now, I do kind of suffer from recency bias and everything, but the book I'm reading right now is called Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb. Nassim Taleb was an options, still is, options trader. He is just a... kind of a Renaissance guy, mathematician, philosopher, avid reader, and reads 30 to 60 hours a week. I really pay attention to people that read a lot because I believe that the breadth of their ideas is either larger than most or the solidity of the ideas that they have is more solid than most. I don't know anybody that reads more than that, but just a super interesting person all around. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this book, Anti-Fragile, you mentioned that optionality is kind of a hedge against or a way to success or a hedge against failure. That's kind of his whole thesis of this book. And it is so, part of why I love it is it affirms me as an entrepreneur. He believes the world belongs to the doers and the tinkerers. And he actually makes a pretty strong argument that all of academia is just in response to people who tried stuff. And theory has no relation to practice other than it follows practice. And so anyway, this book is like becoming one of my favorite books of all time. And specifically as it applies to business, I've already, you know, started proliferating some of the stuff to our team that like, guys, part of our job is to continue towards the plan and build towards our plan and our goals. But we have to keep optionality along the way. Otherwise we might miss the biggest opportunity in front of us. So I put that in my investor update yesterday and I can't get enough of this book. I'm going to be so sad to finish it. But it's kind of his magnum opus. It's so good.
So Elliot, where can people find Link? Where can they find you guys online?
Great question. Link, I had to spell it differently because we're a startup, LINQ. If you Google that, you'll see the Link Hotel in Vegas and you'll see us. No relation. But linkapp.com, LINQAPP.com. I'm linkapp.com/Elliot, 2 L's, 2 T's. Yeah, we're in the App Store. We're on the internet. We're everywhere.
And then if you're lucky enough, meet one of you guys or one of your users in real life.
Scan my watch band.
Scan a watch band, scan a digital business card, QR code, all of it.
Everywhere.
Great. Elliot, thanks so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is my first podcast in a while, and I don't think I've ever had more fun.
Oh, great.